Good morning to everybody. It's good to see you. It's good to be back home. I was in Southern California until Thursday. Got home Thursday night and bring greetings to you from the Christians in the Ontario Church of Christ, just south of Los Angeles. And I know they'd appreciate you knowing about them and your prayers for them. California is a tough place, morally and otherwise, to live, and they're standing for the truth and trying to do what's right, and I know they'd appreciate your thoughts and your prayers for them. Thank you for your part in letting me do this kind of work, gospel meeting work, and trying to teach planned and purposeful lessons in the best way I can do, and that's it's important work, and thank you. You're all part of that, and you let me do that, and you encourage me, and I appreciate that. Thanks for being on that trip and in that work in California. Last Tuesday was election day here and all over the country. And last Tuesday, before my daughter Beth went to the polls to vote, she decided that it was a good day to explain voting to Noah and Tabitha. That's 4 years old and 2 years old. And so I don't know all that was said in that conversation as she explained how what was happening in our country. But as they were leaving the house and heading to the car, Noah said, will you vote for me, Mommy? I want to be in charge. Will you vote for me, Mommy? I want to be in charge. I think sometimes it seems like everyone kind of thinks like a four-year-old little boy, and everyone wants to be in charge. There are a few things that a child needs to learn that are more important and more pivotal in their life than who's in charge. And if a child doesn't get that really clear in their mind when they are young and accept that and embrace that, they're going to be for a world of hurt until sometime, probably through some hard knocks in life, they begin to realize that they are not in charge. And to get that clear and get the concept of authority well established and their place in that when they're young is really, really important. You might have heard recently there was, the day after the election, I think, there was a White House correspondent who acted like he was in charge in a press conference, only to find that out that the result of his shameful and his disrespectful behavior was that the President of the United States was the one who is in charge. And he had his press privileges revoked and so on. This idea of who is in charge really is an important thing to wrestle with. The authority to direct and to command obedience and to be in charge, it rests with parents, it rests with teachers and coaches and police officers, and it rests with the President of the United States. But is there anyone, or is there any power that is over all of those authorities? I mean, is there an authority above all authority? Is there anyone who is at the top of the pyramid who is ultimately in charge? And there's no one above him. Is there anyone like that? Okay, in this audience, I know that the answer is easy for us because it is God. I think that it is increasingly more questionable in this world as to who's in charge, and that there are a lot of people who imagine that they are the ones who are in charge. And so, okay, and we can understand that, but that's not the right answer. That's not the right way to think, and that there are hard knocks that follow that kind of foolish thinking is not a surprise to us. The one who made all things is in charge, the one who is before everything else, is clearly has the right to be in charge. He has inherent authority by his very nature. The one who will end all of these things is the one who is in charge. And the one who will judge all people is the one who clearly is in charge. So at the top of this pyramid rests God, the God of the Bible. In Isaiah chapter 52 and at verse number 7, he was oppressed and he was, I'm sorry, chapter 52 verse 7. How lovely on the mountains are the feet of him who brings good news, who announces peace and brings good news of happiness, who announces salvation and says to Zion, your king reigns, your God reigns. That's Isaiah 52 verse 7. Your God is the king. Genesis chapter 1, verse 1, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. And in Revelation chapter 1, verse 8, and other places in the book of Revelation, Jesus Christ is described as the Alpha and the Omega, the beginning of the alphabet and the end of the alphabet. He is the beginning and the end. The purpose of this lesson is not to present the evidence for the existence of God, to show that there is a God and he is his place in creation and his place in the judgment day, is not to present the evidence for that, but to say that the one who is at the top of the pyramid is God and his place there is deserved. He is to receive complete and unrivaled authority over all things. And he is to receive, he has complete authority over all people. This is expressed, this authority that God has is expressed through Jesus Christ in Matthew chapter 28 and verse number 18. If you'll turn over there, Jesus giving his instructions to the apostles before he departed. Jesus came and spoke to them, saying, all authority has been given to me in heaven and on earth. So God possesses all authority, and he has given this authority to be exercised through Jesus Christ. A man has a long history of being unwilling to accept this authority, and a long history of being unwilling to abide under that authority. Remember the story in the Garden of Eden, God's authority, God's instruction, and men's rebellion there. And that has held true since then, and you and I have seen it happen in our own lives. Understanding, accepting, and abiding under the authority of God has been a difficult thing for people to accept. Turn over in your Old Testaments to Jeremiah chapter 10. Jeremiah chapter 10 and verses 23 and 24. When man revolts against the idea of God having authority, there being a God, or that God has the right to command and direct our actions, when that's rebelled against, some terrible things happening. I want to call your attention to what's said in this passage. Jeremiah chapter 10 and verse 23 and 24. I know, O Lord, that a man's way is not in himself, nor is it in a man who walks to direct his steps. Verse 24. Correct me, O Lord, but with justice, not with your anger, or you will bring me to nothing. Okay. We just do not have it within us to direct our own steps. I mean, we may try, but it's going to make a mess of things. And the prayer in verse 24 is for the Lord to correct me. Not with your anger, lest you bring me to nothing. Proverbs chapter 14 and verse number 12, that there is a way that seems right to a man, but its end are the ways of death. It looks right, but it's not right. So God has authority. If that's usurped, that's going to create some problems. And a mess is going to be made. Judges chapter 21, verse number 25, it's the last verse in the book of Judges, is sort of an appropriate description for what the book of Judges is about. And that every man did what was right in his own eyes. Okay, find out where that kind of thinking leads. Instead of submitting to God's authority, push God aside, and each person does what's right in their own eyes, what kind of society does that create? What relationship to God does that result in? The book of Judges tells you it's a tragic and sad book. We don't have the ability, it is just not in us to direct our own steps, Jeremiah said. Or in the book of Ecclesiastes, and we talked about that book a couple of weeks ago, on a personal level, not on a national level like Judges was talking about, but on a personal level, Solomon tried to do it his own way, and he had ability and wisdom and power, and he could bring to himself anything that his eyes desired, and he pretty much did. And it was empty and wasted life. It's like striving after the wind. I mean, Noah has to learn who's in charge. And so do we. And it's a wrestling match. And it's not as easy to do it as it is to talk about it. But if we push God aside and don't get this idea clear in our mind, and then become comfortable orienting ourselves in a subjected way to God, we're in for misery in our lives. And so there is a sense in which what I want to say this morning, if I could, like a builder building a foundation, if I could establish the point of this sermon just as clearly as I possibly can, to lay this stone so solid in your mind and in my mind that it'll always be there, that's what I've prayed for. That's what I pray that this will do. It is this fundamental of a subject. Who's in charge? And how do we relate to Him? And then in just a moment, how do we gain from Him what He wants us to do? And these things are just really important to set clear in our minds. Looking toward the end of the Bible, 2 John verse number 9. 2 John verse number 9. Anyone who goes too far and does not abide in the teaching of Christ does not have God. The one who abides in the teaching, he has both the Father and the Son. If anyone comes to you and does not bring this teaching, do not receive him into your house, and do not give him a greeting. And so there is this. There is a boundary that is established. And we are to abide in the teaching of Christ. And if we go too far, if we transgress and go beyond that, we are outside of our fellowship with God. We've lost that. We've surrendered that. So not only does God have authority, but we are to abide within that. And the authority expressed is through Jesus Christ and through His teaching. Galatians chapter 1, verses 6 and 7, in the midst of the problems that the churches of Galatia were wrestling with, Paul said, well, here's the problem. You have departed from the teaching that you have received. Paul and the others preached the gospel there, and they were to abide in that, but they were not doing that. Paul was quite surprised how quickly they had moved away from the gospel of Christ. We're not even permitted to add things to this divine revelation, and we're certainly not permitted to take away from it. Deuteronomy chapter 4 and Revelation chapter 22 are rather famous parts of the Bible that warn about adding to or subtracting from divine revelation. And things will get messed up in our relationship with God. Things will get messed up in our lives or in churches when this principle is forgotten. Matthew chapter 15 and verse number 9, worship becomes vain when instead of being guided by divine revelation, it's directed, it's dictated by the doctrines of men. However interesting or exciting or different that might look, it has moved beyond divine revelation. And Matthew chapter 15, verse 9, Jesus quotes from an Old Testament passage to make the point that worship then is vain. It's empty. And the problem, the issue is the same. It's an issue of authority. Who has the right to direct things? Who's in charge here? And when it comes to worship, God is in charge here. And if we get that messed up and our worship is directed in some other way, we ought not be surprised that God notices that and that He calls that worship vain. We've got to keep in mind who is in charge. Matthew chapter 5, 6, and 7, this idea of how are we to live so as to be right before God? We got to understand who's in charge there too. And clearly, Jesus was talking to some people who had their own concept of how to be right before God. Jesus corrected that and addressed that in that very fundamental principle in the Sermon on the Mount. So there's a lot of examples of what happens and the problems that arise when this issue of who is in charge is not really clearly understood. If that foundation stone is not laid solidly in the minds of people, then things invariably will get messed up. So if you don't have God's approval for what you do, or what you say, how you worship, and how you live your life, then you've got to come back to and remember that God is in charge and you are not. God is the boss. God has authority. And He has not given us that authority. We are not allowed to direct our own steps. Try if we want to and we will fail, as history has clearly shown. Okay, so Let me move now from having us tried to say just for a few moments who's in charge to a related subject, and really an essentially related subject, and that's this. How can we learn what God has directed? Okay, so if we understand that there is a God and we understand He has authority and we want Him to have authority, how do we know what He has directed us, directed concerning us and our behavior? Okay, so I want to say again that it is not the purpose of this lesson to provide the evidence that this book is a book from God. The evidence is tremendous, and it's a fascinating study, and the mountain of evidence is overwhelming. This is a book from God. I'm not going to take time to try to prove all of that, but to say simply that God has revealed who He is. God has revealed His nature, His historical relationship to man, and He has revealed His plan for us. He has spoken to us in the Bible. Okay, and so in a general way, that's how we know what God wants us to do. We go to the Bible. We use, in understanding the Bible, reading from it, learning from it, we use the tools that God has given to us that are essential for human communication to understand God's communication to us, just like we understand communication in other areas of life. Now, I'm going to elaborate on that just a little bit in a moment. But let me see if I can give you an example of what I mean. And what I'm getting at is we use God-given tools to understand things. And we take those same tools, or supposed to, and we learn from the Bible. Okay, here's an example. I want to take you with me into a foreign airport. I want to take you into the airport in Sierra Leone. You get off the plane, the door opens, you walk across the airstrip for a little bit. The air is hot and heavy in humidity, and there's this little bitty airport, and you walk inside, and nobody is speaking English, and it's all unfamiliar, and you wonder, what in the world am I supposed to do? And there are people in uniform, and you are a long way from home, and so you probably ought to be careful, and you want to do what's right. But how do you know what you're supposed to do in a foreign airport? Okay, well, let me suggest that you look to see if there are any commands. This is supposed to be a C here. Are there any commands? Are there any direct statements? Are there any arrows? Is there a stop sign in red that says, is there anything that is directly stated? Any commands that are given? And yes, there are. There'll probably be a soldier who'll stand there and he'll do this. He may not speak English very well or not at all, but you know he has given you a direct command, and that command is to stop. Sometimes there are signs and symbols that don't require language, like they'll make a picture of a piece of luggage, and you'll know, okay, well, that's, and an arrow, and okay, I'm supposed to walk that way in order to pick up my baggage. There'll be something that is a direct command or something like that. But it is real interesting that in order to get through that airport, that's not going to be enough. And what you'll end up doing is watching people. And as you get to this little box, and inside the box are some officers, and you'll watch and say, okay, what am I supposed to do here? How do I do this? And if they successfully navigate that part of entry into Sierra Leone, then you can be pretty much sure that maybe you can too. So what kind of documents do they have? Are they going to ask for your boarding pass? Are they going to ask for your luggage tags? Do they want your passport? Do they want to see your visa? Do they want to know how much money you're carrying into their country? I mean, what are they going to ask for there? And you'll watch. And their example will show, if they navigate it successfully, if it is an approved example, then you'll be able to get through that as well. There are a lot of things that you can watch for in the behavior of people. Even in the United States, you go onto an airplane and you walk through security and you have to go through a body scan. And in order to know what to do there, you'll see a guy standing on the other end and he'll say, put your hands up over your head like this. And you'll follow his example. You stand there and put your feet on the thing, just put your hand up, zoop, and you walk right on through there if you're not carrying any metal on you. And Steve, you would not be successful getting through that, I'm afraid. But there, you're following the example of somebody who's telling you what you're supposed to do and how you're supposed to handle things. So let me just show that the second thing that you'll do is an example. You'll watch people, and you'll see what they do to get successfully through there. Documents, in Sierra Leone, they want you to put your two index fingers on this pad, and they'll scan your fingerprints, I guess, against a database, I guess, to see if you're a terrorist, or I'm not sure what they're looking for. But I didn't know how to use that until the guy on the inside of the booth said, I said, oh, okay. And I put my fingers on the pad and everything worked just fine. I followed his example. He didn't speak a word, but he showed me what I... You learn what you're supposed to do sometimes by a command and sometimes by an example. And they work very effectively in navigating new territory. But inside the airport in Sierra Leone, there is a little booth set there. And inside the booth is a lady and a couple of guys and... They're not in uniform, and they exchange money for you. And I get a little bit suspicious about that. And I wonder, okay, is this legit? Can I trust them? If I give them $200, will they give me the equivalent in Sierra Leone currency? But you know, the necessary inference is, the conclusion that happens in the minds of most people is, if this booth is set inside a government facility like an airport, then they're probably going to be monitoring this the transactions there, and that this is a legitimate enterprise. The truth of the matter is, some of the best rates for converting currency is found at the airport. But you can conclude that not because there's a sign, not really because of an example, but because you're putting the information together and you are drawing the necessary conclusions. I conclude that if I send a visa application to Washington, D.C. to enter Sierra Leone, and they fill it all out and they mark my passport and they send my passport back to me, the conclusion that I come to is that I won't have any problem getting into Sierra Leone. What happens in Washington, D.C. will allow me to get into Sierra Leone. There's no paper that says that. There's no command. I'm not following an example particularly, but I'm drawing a conclusion that the embassy, Sierra Leone embassy in Washington, D.C. lets me into their country. And you know what? It works every time. It's exactly what. There's a lot of things. Where did I put it? There's a lot of things that happen like this. There is a necessary inference. A necessary inference. A conclusion that you come to confidently based on the circumstances that are true and accurate and right. We learn things by direct statements, that is, that somebody tells us something. We learn things in life. We learn things that someone else wants or expects of us by examples, watching them. And we learn what's expected by a necessary inference. Someone is implying things that we are clearly supposed to see. We learn by things being told to us, being shown to us, or being implied to us. Told, shown, implied. Told, shown, implied. That's the way human beings work. Now, I wrote those letters up there, C-E-N-I. And I want to say, just to add a little bit to this lesson, that there are, in the Bible, the subject of love is taught to us in those three ways. We are told to love. We are commanded that. The example of Jesus shows us love, and the implication, the necessary implication, is that the command given to the Christians in the first century to love, that it applies to us too, and that we're supposed to love just like Jesus did. So we learn about love by being told and being shown and by implication. That happened. We're told that we learn about the Lord's Supper that way as well. Jesus commands his disciples to take the Lord's Supper. We're shown in Acts chapter 20 and verse 7 that they took it on the first day of the week. And the necessary inference or the implication is, that's what Christians are always to do. And that the practice of the early church is the practice that we are to follow today. So we learn using these same tools. See them at work in Acts chapter 15 as the Christians worked through a particular problem about how to become a Christian and whether the Old Testament law was to be a part of being a faithful Christian. As they worked through that and talked about it, you can see in verse 7 that God showed them the right answer. In verse 12, there were things implied concerning the truth. And then finally in verses 13 to 18, they were told directly what they were supposed to do. The same three things. You tell, you show, you imply. God tells, God shows, and God implies. C-E-N-I has become kind of a target that some have shot at, who think that is a restrictive and inappropriate way of handling the scriptures. They reject the idea that people are to read the Bible expecting that God will reveal himself in a command, an example, or a necessary inference. And they, so they take C-E-N-I and they mock that as an artificial, man-made way of interpreting the Bible. I want to say a couple things about that. Number one, those are tools that are used to identify what God has directed us to do. Second thing I want to say about that is if someone is uncomfortable with a command, with commands, examples, and necessary inferences, please do this. Please do this. Explain your objection without using command, example, or necessary inference. Explain your objection to telling, showing, and implying without telling, showing, and implying. I don't think it can be done. And the reason I don't think it can be done is those are the only tools, those are the tools that we use to express our wishes, our desires, our expectations to someone else. These are the tools. And guess what? Those are the tools God has used to step into this world of human communication and to tell us what He directs, what He wants us to do, what He wishes for us. And so God has authority. He is in charge. He has expressed Himself in the Bible. And so in order to understand what He wants us to do, we are looking, does He tell us? Is there a direct statement about His will? Does He show us through the examples of others whom He approves, does He show us what He wants done? And then does He imply His acceptance of things by the information given that surrounds a particular topic? And when we understand His will or wishes using the same tools that we understand one another's will and wishes, then we have understood the directions that God has given to us. In the airport in Sierra Leone, you'll see a couple of lines. One of them will say, passports. And the other line will say, Sierra Leone passports. One is giving general instruction and one is giving specific instruction. Okay, so I look at my passport, it's an American passport. I'm in line with people from passports from all over the world, and I don't even think about going in that Sierra Leone line. I follow the general instruction, passports go here. So the Sierra Leone government gives sometimes general authority, general, expresses their will and wishes in general ways. Passports go here. Which passport? Any passport. You got a passport? Then you can go in this line. Sometimes the Sierra Leone government expresses its will and wishes specifically. Specifically. Sierra Leone passports go here. Oh, okay. And then if you got a Sierra Leone passport, then you walk that way. God does the same thing. So we do the same thing. We express our will and wishes sometimes generally and sometimes specifically. God authorizes, gives approval sometimes to a wide range of specifics within an authorized general category. Like he tells Christians that we are to assemble. There's things we are to do, but where are we supposed to assemble? What's it supposed to look like? You can assemble by the riverbank. You can assemble in an upper room, a rented facility, buy a facility. God's instructions are general there. And a number of specific things within that general authorization would be fine because His authority is expressed in a general way. Jesus told the apostles to go into all the world. And so you can fly on an airplane, you can ride in a boat, you can walk. There's a number of ways to obey the general command to go. Or for Noah to be instructed to build an ark. Well, what tools are we supposed to use? God did not specify. He gave general authority to build the ark. And so what it takes to do God's instruction, those things that it takes are authorized, not specifically, but they're authorized because God gave general instruction to build the ark, didn't specify. Now, concerning the ark, there were some things God did specify. Build it out of gopher wood. So when God gives specific instruction, like Sierra Leone passports go here, when God gives specific instruction, gopher wood, well, then we're not permitted. Noah would not be permitted to build the ark with some other kind of wood. God gives, God expresses his will and wishes both in a general way and in specific ways as well. The Lord's Supper, the emblems that Jesus used to institute this memorial were unleavened bread and the fruit of the vine, grape juice. Those emblems were given specifically. So we're not at liberty to say, well, God's given general instructions, and so we could use Coke, we could have leavened bread, we have loaf bread, we could have peanut butter on it, we could just, it doesn't matter. God did not give general instructions about the Lord's Supper. He gave specific instructions about the emblems that are to be used there, and so we must respect, we must understand God's expression of his will, just like we would understand if we communicated to each other in that way. We discern between what's generally authorized, what's generally instructed, and what's specifically instructed. And we must recognize that when it comes to discerning God's will too. He directs us. He has the authority to do that. And we must use the same tools in reading the Bible and approaching God that we use with one another. And so let me just conclude by saying two things I want to make sure we got clear and that I have gotten clear across. That God's the one who is in charge. It is God who has all authority here. And we must never forget that. And we must live our lives beneath his authority and do it happily, voluntarily. We must recognize it, we must seek his authority, and we must remain within his authority. Number two, God shows us what he directs of us in the Bible. And we learn there what we are supposed to do in the same way we learn all things in life from anyone who is in authority, whether it is a parent or whether it is a government official over an airport in Sierra Leone. We learn how to understand what's expected of us. We know these tools. We use them without even thinking about them. And the sad thing is, when it comes to the Bible, there are people who want to discard those tools and handle the Bible in a unique way that's heading in the wrong direction. People have come to self-direct their lives, and it sometimes is evident in how the Lord's Supper is handled. There are people who don't take the Lord's Supper every Sunday. There are people who have changed the emblems that are taken in the Lord's Supper. There are people who have come to direct themselves. They use instrumental music in the worship of the Lord's church when such instruction is not found from the one at the top of the pyramid who has all authority. So however interesting or exciting or common that might be, the decision about the use of instrumental music is not answered, not solved that way. What does the king say? What does the one who has all authority say? What is he taught and what is he shown and what is he implied that we are to do? And the same in regard to fundraising for the church. The free will offering of members of a local congregation is sometimes viewed as not enough. And so fundraising efforts of yard sales and rummage sales and other such things to raise money for a local church are deemed to be okay. Well, if they are okay, then God must authorize them. So, okay, has he done that? Let's seek the will of Christ and see. So we must be very careful not to follow clever ways that are used to justify the doctrines of men. We must be very careful not to find ourselves accepting religious denominationalism when Jesus said we are to be one and we are not to be divided. We're to teach the same thing. Be careful that we don't accept clowns for Jesus and as a way for evangelism or other means of defining the work of the church that might be popular or people might deem will be more effective than what God has authorized in the Bible. Be very careful of all of this. And these are ways in which this sort of fundamental lesson needs to be applied. Respect the authority of Jesus Christ. Read and obey His Word. Do it with integrity. What has He told us? What has He shown us? What has He implied to be true? What has He said in a general way? What has He said in specific ways? Read and study the Bible with integrity, so that when all is said and done, Colossians chapter 3 and verse number 17 applies to your life and mine as well. Whatever you do in word or deed, do all in the name of the Lord Jesus, giving thanks through Him to God the Father. Whatever you do in word or deed, whatever, do it in the name of Jesus. Have the what the Lord is and what He's taught and what He stands for, have that standing behind everything you say. Have it standing behind everything that you do. And that's the life of someone who is acknowledging that it is Jesus Christ who sits on the throne. That's the life of someone who is acknowledging that Jesus Christ is Lord in their life. They're not directing things. They're not the boss. They're not in charge. God is. So what does He say about our lives, our marriage, our families? What does He say about the church? What does He say about worship? What does He say about the Lord's Supper? Or how a congregation expresses praise to God? And what He says settles things because He's in charge. That certainly is true in regard to being a Christian and this matter of salvation. God's in charge. And there are all kinds of creative ways to describe how to become a Christian, but we're not interested in those. You're not interested in what I might imagine about that. You're interested in knowing what the Bible says. And I know you know that. It's a process of hearing, believing, repenting, confessing your faith, and being baptized. It's a process that leads to a changed life, dead to sin and alive to Christ, and a new walking in newness of life, so that everything you say and everything you do has the Lord standing behind that. That's what this process is about. And if you need to enter Christ and become a Christian, we hope you'll do that this morning and do it in the Bible way. Do it in the Bible way and live your life for Him. If we can help you to return to that and be faithful to the Lord as you should, let us know how we can do that while we stand to sing this invitation song.